Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, The Last Kings of Hollywood, how Lucas, Coppola and Spielberg battled for the soul of American cinema. Ireland's favourite scientist Luke O'Neill looks at some of the hard and soft science in some of your favourite Hollywood films. Plus all the week's new TV and new films reviewed and dissected, including the Super Mario Galaxy movie, and your chance to win tickets to the new Jim Jarmusch movie Father, Mother, Sister, Brother, along with a two-night stay in the luxurious five-star Annatara The Marker Dublin Hotel. You can email the show screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio on News Talk. Good day to you all. I do hope you're having a pleasant Easter weekend and what's left of it. This week in TV, before I get to what I was watching in TV per se, the thing that excited me the most in TV this week was something I kind of watched reluctantly. My son asked me and his mother if he could watch the Artemis 2 space launch. And I was kind of, I don't know, indifferent about it. I hadn't given it much thought. Ah, you've seen one space launch, you've seen them all. But we went onto YouTube and watched it on NASA TV. And it was thrilling. There was a little delay. And then we watched the countdown clock. And, you know, they have so much more technology now that it seems you can see this all a lot better and hear what's going on and ground control and all that kind of stuff. So it was a pretty thrilling piece of TV, aside from, you know, what it means for the world and all that. And I know a lot of people have said it this week, but there was something very nice about, you know, human endeavor heading into space as opposed to all the horrible crap that's happening on the Earth at the moment. There was something very unifying and pleasant about this spaceship from NASA heading into the skies. It reminded you of a happier time, I have to say. So that was something I was watching in TV this week that did thrill me in ways I hadn't expected. But to the more, not pedestrian TV, because this is far from pedestrian, but to the stuff, other stuff you might have been watching. Take a listen to this.
When you love someone, is you believe the person that you love. That's what trust is. So when you told me that you believed me, instead of looking at a catalog of all the things you've said in the past, because I am seeing you in the moment, in every moment, I am looking at you and you don't do that for me. You don't. You chose a version of me a long time ago and that's all I am. And then you get frustrated when I'm not it, because then you don't know who to be. And you know what? It's bad, Nikki. It's a bad quality, because you have made it impossible for me to exist.
Now, that is a clip from Something Very Bad Is Going to Happen. It landed on Netflix late last week, and it is executive produced by the Duffer Brothers, who gave us the behemoth that is Stranger Things. So this is their new vehicle. And in it, we have Rachel, played by Camila Morrone, who's actually the stepdaughter of Al Pacino. And she's driving with her fiancé, Nicky, played by Adam DeMarco, to his family's woodland cabin for their wedding. And this wedding is going to take place a week from when the action starts. And this is a very creepy, spooky kind of horror series, 8 episodes. And even on the drive there, weird things are happening. Like there's a peeping Tom in a restroom. There's a baby seemingly abandoned in a rest stop. Rachel gets a note saying, don't marry him. Odd things happen. The oddness increases when they get to in-laws, and he has a very strange family in this very wealthy middle American cabin in the woods. They're kind of trying, his family are trying to take over the wedding, and they have her wedding dress ready for her. Very creepy things happen. Like her wedding dress disappears. I really like this. It's kind of scary in places. Well, in lots of places. It's gory at times. It's really weird. There was a David Lynchian vibe to it at times. There was also a kind of Hammer horror feel to it as well. So it was modern yet old-fashioned with a brilliant central performance by Camila Morrone. So I'm giving this a big thumbs up. If you like a bit of meaty, spooky horror, albeit over 8 episodes, Something Very Bad Is Going to Happen is definitely worth your viewing time. I also want to mention a 6-part show on BBC that landed on Sunday and Monday night, or Monday and Tuesday night, called Babies. And it follows a couple, Stephen, played by Papa Ezzedu, and Lisa, played by our own brilliant Siobhan Cullen. And they are a couple in their 30s who are navigating the heartache caused by baby loss and miscarriage, and they're struggling to conceive. This is deeply, deeply affecting. It's looking at how this couple navigate this heartache. And I suppose there is caution advised in that it is very sad at times and very hard to watch. And there are heartbreaking moments, and in particular, when they go for a 12-week scan and all is not as it was hoped it would be. This is heartbreakingly beautiful. It's not an easy watch at times. And if you're not in the mood to look at this subject or watch a show about miscarriage and stuff like that, this is definitely not for you. But as someone said earlier in the week, Serena Bellissimo, that, you know, a show like this helps people feel seen when they've gone through something like that and are going through something like that. So this is brilliant, but very sad. And, you know, I said it earlier in the week, we were talking about it on The Hard Shoulder. This is why we have public sector broadcasting. I'm not sure if this would get made if we didn't have a thing like the BBC, or indeed RTE. But, you know, the BBC will show shows like this because they have an importance over and above getting people to watch it. That is Babies, 6-part drama on BBC, and Siobhan Cullen is terrific in it, as she is in everything. Do let me know what you might have been watching. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. Now, we have a terrific competition this week. Father, Mother, Sister, Brother is an intimate, engaging and carefully constructed family portrait of everyday life and relationships from the great Jim Jarmusch, featuring a great cast, Kate Blanchett, Tom Waits, the great Tom Waits, Adam Driver and Charlotte Rampling. The three stories all concern the relationships between adult children, their somewhat distant parent or parents, and each other. The movie was actually partially filmed in Stonybatter in Dublin and co-produced by Irish production company Hail Mary Pictures and supported by Screen Ireland. It also recently picked up the Golden Lion at the 2025 Venice International Film Festival. Mother, Father, Sister, Brother is in cinemas nationwide next week on Friday the 10th of April. And I'm telling you that because we have a great prize, because we have a pair of tickets to Father, Mother, Sister, Brother in a city of your choice, a copy of the film soundtrack by Jim Jarmusch and Anika on vinyl, plus a 2-night stay in the luxurious 5-star Anatara, the Marker Dublin Hotel, including a Poetry and Places afternoon tea in the elegant surroundings of the Marker Bar. What a great competition. So if you'd like to be in with a chance of winning, give me the answer to this reasonably simple question, but it is one for the movie and TV watchers. Adam Driver famously starred in, and I suppose came to great prominence, in a TV show about a group of female friends in New York. He was one of the boyfriends. Was that show A, Girls, or B, Sex in the City? If you know the answer to that question, simply text the word film, followed by your answer and name to us now on 53106. That's 53106. And the text will cost 30 cents. And we'll let you know the winner next week. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talks TV and movie show. We turn to the big new release of the week, of the Easter. Is it the best kids movie ever, or is it a shameless money grab for parents who want to do something with their kids over the Easter holidays? I am, of course, referring to the sequel to the highly successful Super Mario movie from 3 years ago, which is called Super Mario Galaxy Movie. Delighted to be joined by Ken Doran, movie reviewer, who's here to review and has seen it. Ken, hello, how are you?
I'm doing well, how are you?
Very good. So listen, I took some of my children, I can't remember who, to the first one, and I remember being pleasantly surprised. I thought the animation was nice. I thought the way they kind of aped the initial game worked kind of well. I can't really remember the story at all, but I thought it was pretty decent. Does that pick up from this new one, which is called somewhat unwieldingly the Super Mario Galaxy movie?
No, I think this one kind of takes everything that was established in the first one and then takes a little bit more and throws it all together. And I think it becomes a little bit too messy.
Okay.
As you said, yeah, the first one, pretty well received.
Yeah,
you know?
And mega successful financially.
Yes. Definitely. And, you know, just straight up, I'd say this one is probably going to be the same. Despite the kind of mixed reviews, I'd say this'll do well. But so as we established in the last one, we kind of pick up there. So Mario and Luigi, they're back kind of doing adventures.
And for people who don't know, these guys, most people do, but they're from the original Nintendo video game. Yeah. They are Italian-American plumbers, right?
Yeah. That's it. I mean, there's not
that it really matters, but...
No, and to be fair, in the original games, there's not a whole lot. This has kind of been developed over the years throughout different kind of media. So we pick up with these guys as they've been set up. They're kind of going on adventures, and we are introduced to a few new characters. So Yoshi, who people might be familiar with, is introduced in this, and he's voiced by Donald Glover.
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting. We'll come back to that. But
I think we should.
So he's introduced, and he kind of becomes part of the team. A new princess is introduced, Rosalina. She's voiced by, what's her name? Captain Marvel.
Brie Larson.
Brie Larson, that's the one. She's in this as well. And there's another character who kind of gets introduced later from a different video game, who's voiced by Glenn Powell.
Wow.
So there's a lot kind of going on. And, I think
Jack Black is in there as well.
Jack Black is in it. He returns as well as Bowser.
And Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt is Mario, Charlie Day is Luigi. So
this is a big voice cast.
It's a big voice cast, which is kind of interesting because generally, you know, when you get these kind of star-studded star-studded cast, it's because you want to sell the movie, you want to put bums in seats. But for a kids movie like Mario, and it's definitely aimed at kids, I don't think that's going to appeal to children.
Yeah.
You know, no 10-year-old is going to care, oh, Glenn Powell is in this, I have
absolutely
to go see that. So
absolutely.
And it kind of, I think, is to the detriment of the film, but we'll get back to that in a little bit. So we're introduced to the same characters from before. I think everyone's returning except for Donkey Kong, who was in the last one. So we have more or less the same characters, a few more, and this new princess, Rosalina, is kidnapped by Bowser's son. Basically, Bowser, at the end of the last one, was defeated. He's living with the guys now and kind of rehabilitating, trying to, you know, acclimate to being a normal non-villain type person.
Right.
And his son kidnaps a princess and busts him out and kind of reminds him of the villain that he used to be.
Okay.
And
so Bowser turns bad again.
And the kind of crux of it is he's invented this new Bowser planet that has this giant laser that can, you know, destroy the galaxy, and it's powered by this princess. And the gang needs to get together and kind of go on a road trip of sorts to save this new princess. And that's kind of it. There's not a whole lot more going on than that. And I think that's kind of what people are saying is there's not a lot to it. There's a lot of style, but there's not a lot of substance, you know, even in terms of things going on underneath. And I know this is a Mario movie, so it sounds a little bit silly to say, you know, that there should be some kind of subtext. But when you think about the first film, when we're introduced to these characters, even if you've got a passing kind of familiarity to Mario, they go the extra mile to say, well, this is Mario and he's, you know, he's got a lot of potential, but he hasn't quite found his place in the world. And this is Luigi and he's a little bit cowardly. And in the film, they kind of overcome that. In this, we don't really have any kind of journey like that.
Yeah.
They're kind of brave and adventurous at the start of the film, and that continues on for the length of it, you know?
I don't think you should apologize for looking for some kind of subtext in a kid's movies, because the best ones have it. Last week I was talking to Nicola Cochran about the new movie that's still in cinemas, The Magic Faraway Tree, and there is this subtext about Andrew Garfield and his family go to this forest, and they're or this country house they're going to live in, and it's getting away from technology, and they revel in nature, and all good kids movies, I think, have that kind of lesson for kids and adults. So don't apologize for wanting that, Ken. Right in your wanting.
I agree. Like, and I will say, I admit, you know, I'm not the target demographic for this film. It's aimed at kids, but as you say, there's no excuse for being mediocre. And
absolutely,
and this is it.
So there's just no proper story here to keep you going.
No, there's no story, and there's a kind of a weird juxtaposition in tone, I think, that kind of it takes away from the movie. So as I said, you have this crazy voice cast, big Hollywood stars, but I don't know where this kind of came from. Sometime in the early 2000s, where we started filling, or Hollywood, I should say, started filling their animated films with these big voice, these big casts, but not necessarily voice actors.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is, for this kind of movie, it needs to be a bit over the top. It needs to be kind of cartoonish, because if you're not going over the top when it's Super Mario Galaxy and it's, you know, crazy stuff, it feels very lackluster.
Okay.
And Chris Pratt is probably the worst offender, you know. So you're like watching it, and there's this scene where Princess Peach, who's voiced by Anna Taylor-Joy, she's, you know, kind of upset or frustrated, and Mario comes over to kind of console her, and it's supposed to be this kind of deep conversation between them. But visually, you have the character of Princess Peach and Mario, who is half her size, and his head is three times the size of her torso. Like, it's a bizarre visual. But coming out of that is Chris Pratt doing this very somber kind of, very low energy kind of, oh, I'm empathizing with you. And it just doesn't work, you know.
And it is a skill to voice a cartoon that not every actor has. And your point is also well made about, like, 10-year-old kid doesn't care about Chris Pratt. No. They probably don't even know who he is.
Exactly.
You know, they want a voice that is enlivened. Like, no one knew who the SpongeBob voice was.
No.
But by golly.
Exactly. Or if you think of any of like the classic, and I know this isn't Disney, this is Illumination, but the classic Disney animated things, like who voiced Hercules or Mulan or whatever.
Yeah.
You can have a big name actor kind of in a side character role, maybe, that's not important, but you need someone there who knows what they're doing. I think Jack Black is the only one in this who's really kind of, who gets what it is.
Yeah.
He's kind of hamming it up, and he's kind of the only interesting one. You're kind of, whenever he's not on screen, you're asking, where's Jack Black? Why isn't he on?
How does it all look?
I think it looks okay. It looks like the game, you know. It looks like a very direct translation from game to screen. I think that's probably why it's going to make $1 billion is because we're far from the, you know, the 1993 Bob Hoskins and, you know, John Leguizamo one, where it bears no resemblance to the, we're aiming this at kids. It needs to look like the game.
Yeah.
And that's really all they care about.
I haven't seen this yet, but in about 36 hours from now, I will, with a large gaggle of children. You're leading up to saying, and you have said, this isn't very good and you're going to give me a star rating. Yet there are going to be parents all over Ireland and England and America, because of the time of year, are going to go and see this. So what I really don't like about this is that it's kind of a cash grab.
Yes, yeah, kind of soulless, artistically bankrupt. Yes, these are kind of phrases that
put that on the poster. Artistically bankrupt.
But you know what? Like, I didn't like it, but the kids, when I went to see it, it was an audience of kids of all ages and their parents, and the kids seemed to like it. Despite the fact they clearly were not thinking critically about the kind of thing, the way
I hope you went around and reprimanded them.
I did, yeah. I did.
There's no plotting in this.
But you know what, they were liking it, and as things were being said, they were kind of quoting it back to their friend, you know, in real time, like little phrases that they were kind of latching onto. So it's catching the target demographic.
Well, that's interesting you say that. So a lot of people who listen to this show are who like to go to the movies with their kids, but I do know they like things they're going to be entertained by. But you are saying that kids possibly and probably are, but that mum and dads aren't.
I think, if you're listening to this and you're looking to enjoy something that your kids will enjoy, you're going to have to take the hit on this one.
Yeah,
this one is not for you. This is purely for the kids.
So what star rating are you going to give the Super Mario Galaxy movie?
For me and for the childless adults out there, 2 stars.
Okay, and it sounds like you're being generous.
Yeah, for if you have your kids, they it could be 4 stars for them. But,
okay,
but so maybe meet somewhere in the middle. Let's say 3 stars.
Okay, well, yeah, you're being generous there. Let's go not to tell you how to do it.
No,
but 2 stars from Ken Doran for the Super Mario Galaxy movie. Ken, thank you. We'll finish with a clip.
There's a huge universe out there.
I demand that you release my father.
Over my dead body.
Fine with me.
My Koopas! Your king has returned!
Long live the king!
The Bowser name shall be feared once more!
Oh no!
Everyone calm down!
Toad, pack our things.
Let's go!
Let's go!
Koopas. You're going to regret that.
A clip there from the Super Mario Galaxy movie, which Ken Doran kind of gave 2 stars to and was saying maybe 4 for the kids. Now, after the break, a brilliant new book called The Last Kings of Hollywood, all about the competitive relationship between George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, and Steven Spielberg. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now there is a book just published that I think listeners to this show will be big fans of. The Last Kings of Hollywood, Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg, and the Battle for the Soul of American Cinema. It tells the story of how those 3 directing titans remade American cinema and also their sometimes very complicated relationship. It was written by Paul Fisher, who I'm delighted to say joins me on the line now from somewhere deep in North America. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Hello, John. I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Let me start at the very awkward beginning. The 3 of them had very awkward childhoods, really. I've thought about these filmmakers for a long time, but I never thought about what you make plain in your book, that they had things that bound them together in terms of how kind of out of step they were with what was going on with them, to a certain extent, right?
Yeah, for sure. They're of an interesting generation where they had access to the cameras and recording equipment and tape recorders and stuff at home. And they were all 3 in different ways, I think, the kind of, I guess in modern parlance, you'd call them nerds or dorks or just slightly different kids who were really interested in these kinds of things. You know, Coppola's childhood friends called them science, you know. They were kind of your sort of AV club kids before such a thing. And then in the book, I sort of also kind of start for each of them with a kind of origin story. You know, Francis Coppola had polio. Lucas had a car crash in high school that was kind of influential to him. Steven Spielberg had this peripatetic life encountering anti-Semitism in different ways and feeling like an outsider. So you find the genesis of some of the film themes kind of right there in childhood for all 3 of them in different ways.
Yeah. And, you know, the subtitle of your book, the Battle for the Soul of American Cinema. I mean, do you think when they started their careers, they were intent on doing something different, or were they just keen to tell stories? Like, did they see that they were taking on the Hollywood machine and trying to reshape it, or were they just guys trying to tell the stories? I know that's a very grandiose question.
No, they were grandiose people, really, even as young men. You know, I think that's kind of the genesis of the book, right? Like, people who listen to the show who will know film history will know that one of the ways we talk about kind of the new Hollywood, 70s American cinema, is this idea that these young filmmakers who were creative but a bit crazy and not really responsible came in, and it was a bit like the lunatics taking over the asylum, and they made great films and they went over schedule and over budget, and then eventually the system had to course correct. And what I liked about writing this, or one of the things I liked about writing this, was these 3 guys especially, they came in the late 60s when the American film industry was sort of dead. You know, the studios had gone through 20 rough years and they were having a hard time competing with European film and Asian film and B movies and drive-ins and television, and the old film executives didn't really know how to make films for a younger audience. And these guys came in the case of 2 of them, out of film school, and they were very, very clear and deliberate about, we can change the way films are made, and we can make them without working in the system, and we can make them as freelance artists rather than employees, and we can make personal films that are films that, you know, come out of our life and mean something to us, but there will also be big films, commercial films. We don't need to have a career making, you know, The Sound of Music and stuff. And they had different ways of going about it. You know, Spielberg was very adamant about wanting to work in the system with the tools and toys of the system. And Coppola and Lucas were the opposite. You know, the second they meet as young men, they start talking about, oh, we need to go get a house somewhere and buy all this portable equipment and make films completely out of the system, and show you can do it without ever having to ask for permission or financing from a cigar chomper, as Lucas used to call exactly.
Yeah. And it's funny when you frame it that way, I think by any estimation, they largely succeeded in what they were setting out to do, looking from this distance, or even by the time we get to the 80s and we've had The Godfather and Jaws and Star Wars and E.T., like that mission to rewrite Hollywood and do it a different way, inside or outside the Hollywood system, like mission accomplished, I think, right?
Yeah, mission accomplished. They succeed on such a big scale that it almost boomerangs back, and it's like a wish on a monkey's paw. So they make these films, you know, The Godfather, big crime film, but it's also a personal kind of family Shakespearean thing. Jaws, big monster film, kind of horror thriller film, but it's also about Spielberg's kind of personal kind of concerns with just being an ordinary person in extraordinary circumstances, and the kind of fear that also excites you and all those things. And then, you know, several more films like this, and the peaks are kind of like Star Wars, E.T., mm-hmm. these giant films kind of aimed at, as you were saying, I guess kind of the children that those guys had been, as much as anything. And it works so well, and they figure out a way to make such individual, personal, great commercial films that then the system kind of comes back around and goes, you know what? We need to find a way to share in that success, to take over that success. But we got to cut out these pesky directors who want to keep some of the money and be in charge of all the kind of creative control.
Yeah.
And, you know, fast forward, and that's how we end up with like, oh, what's Star Wars? I guess it's aimed at kids and it's a franchise and it's got special effects. All right, we'll aim stuff at kids that are franchises and have special effects, and we'll worry about making them good or involving a personal filmmaker later. And that's how you end up in a world with, you know, 17 Marvel movies and 12 Jurassic Parks and 8,000 Star Warses and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Let's not get into that now. We're having such a pleasant conversation. tell me this though, right? I mentioned it in the intro, like they love each other, brothers in cinematic arms. But what the book really shows is like they really covet each other at times. And maybe like I had heard a bit about, you know, the Apocalypse Now, but just remind our listeners, like there was a lot of one-upmanship on who was actually going to make that, right?
There was, yeah. So there was originally Apocalypse Now was going to be a George Lucas film. He came up with it at film school with this screenwriter called John Milius, who some people will know. And they wrote a version of it that was meant to be sort of, I think the way they pitched it was Dr. Strangelove crossed with Battle of Algiers, just kind of a satirical guerrilla underground black and white. Very, very dark film. And then it got sort of co-opted into American Zoetrope, which was a company that Coppola and Lucas started together. And then that company failed and it kind of got lost a little bit. And then after the success of the first two Godfather films, Coppola, he had money and he thought, you know what, the way I can become independent is I need a big, popular, easy jungle action film that everybody's going to want to eat popcorn and go see. And you know what? I can take this little Apocalypse Now thing that George has, and we can make that. And so he went to Lucas and said, look, can we make this? And Lucas said, well, I'm doing the Star Wars thing and I'm kind of busy. And so Coppola decided, you know what? I'm going to direct this. I'll make my big popcorn jungle action film. And of course, the film he ends up making is the furthest thing you can have from Rambo or a simple.
And people should just watch the documentary Hearts of Darkness, where we see him losing his mind on the set in essence. But anyway, go on. I'm interrupting you.
No. And he mentions it in the documentary that the plan was like, this is going to be easy. This is going to be almost like making a big Roger Corman film and I'll rake in the cash and it's going to be a blockbuster. But then he just can't help himself again, putting in all that personal stuff and trying to work out something a bit more ambitious. But that thing caused a rift between those two guys for a while. And then, you know, later on when Coppola wanted to build a whole new studio and he thought, you know what, George has Star Wars money, we can build this thing. And Lucas told him, nah, I don't really want to take a risk on one of these boom and bust schemes you have. That created another sort of rift. And so it's a really relatable story in the sense that, like, they are friends. They're still very close friends. And I think it's a very human friendship. And there's no kind of like, oh, these guys hate each other secretly under the surface. But it's very ambitious, egotistical, competitive rivalry in a friendship, at times supportive and at times feeling like, you're stabbing each other in the back. And they're obviously three guys who all, you know, have main character syndrome. Otherwise, why would you say, give me $100 million so I can put my mind on a screen for everybody to sit and watch? You got to be kind of self-involved. And so there's human drama over the whole course of it that's fun and exciting and I think recognizable.
What syndrome did you say they had?
Oh, main character syndrome.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, yeah, I can see that. Like
thinking you're the main character.
Yeah, well, there's three of them. We often bemoan the fact that women are written out of the history of all sorts of things, but your book is very successful in kind of reestablishing some of the key women in their success. And I'm thinking from your book, couple, his wife, Eleanor, his mistress, Melissa Matheson, Kathleen Kennedy, who co-founded Anne Boleyn with Spielberg, apparently Lucas's wife, Marcy, a kind of reworked Star Wars. So like they really had powerful women, you know, not just behind them, but with them. And their success would not be their success without them, right?
No, totally. And it was something about, you know, researching it, you realize, okay, these guys set out wanting to create a creative ecosystem in which they could be creatively and financially independent. And to them, that kind of meant a tussle with the studios and executives and raising funds and all these things. And so in the process, they sort of ignore that there is an ecosystem of a different kind that they're already kind of relying on, which is these women. You know, like Coppola is greatly sustained throughout that period, both by his wife, who was an artist who kind of sacrificed her career to go through the roller coaster ride with him and to almost take the brunt of his insecurities. And Melissa Matheson, this very young woman who he had a long-running extramarital relationship with, who he encouraged to write, who eventually wrote E.T. for Steven Spielberg.
Wow.
So she kind of runs through the whole of it. And then Marcia Lucas, George Lucas's wife, you know, she edited his films. She edited Taxi Driver. She was kind of Martin Scorsese's Thelma Schoonmaker before Thelma was kind of making his films with him. When Lucas made THX 1138, which is quite a dark film, and he was the filmmaker who talked about underground abstract poems, she was the one to kind of say, look, maybe you should make stuff with like emotions in it so people can like engage. You know, she was the one to kind of reshape the whole second half of the first Star Wars film when people were thinking, this isn't really working. It's kind of stodgy. And Spielberg is the one who I think has been the most open about, you know, I like working on sets with women and I like being surrounded by women and I like going back to my mom's diner for lunch when I can make it because I, you know, kind of crave comfort and support. And Kathleen Kennedy, who to many people, I guess, today, you know, she gets vitriol online for having run the kind of Disney version of Lucasfilm for the last several years until she left that post recently. But again, another young woman who came in and had taste and a work ethic and the courage to say no to someone and who became kind of instrumental in that next phase of his life. And so I wanted the book to, it kind of felt like if you don't give people like those women their credit, then you're sort of excluding them for no reason other than you're assuming that because they're women and they're not directors, they're not important to that process. So it felt right to kind of put right.
You mentioned Taxi Driver there and of course, Martin Scorsese, you know, you write about him plenty in the book, but he's not in this triumvirate that you have at the center. Is that because he's one of the greatest living directors? I'm not saying anything negative about him, but is that because he didn't kind of have the same modus operandi as the other three, that maybe he just wanted to tell his own stories, whereas the other three had this vision for reworking Hollywood? Or that's a long way of asking you, why is it not a story about four directors as opposed to three?
It's exactly that, really. Scorsese's in the book almost as a counterweight to those guys in that he had no interest in running the system or becoming a mogul or changing things. He just wanted to make the films, focus on the films, and almost his journey, quote unquote, throughout the book is this idea of a young, equally ambitious filmmaker, but in a different way, who gets to a point where actually his idea of freedom isn't to be able to pay for whatever film he wants or to have a studio or that kind of thing. His idea of freedom is to be able to make the film he is making there and then in that moment. as if it's his last one without compromising. And there's similar dynamics. You know, I spoke to Scorsese's first wife, Lorraine, who has never spoken to anybody on the record before, who he married kind of out of NYU and then left when he went to LA. And so there's similar dynamics, but he came to a place where, you know, Brian De Palma told me, Coppola invited De Palma and Scorsese to go up to San Francisco and see American Zoetrope, this company Coppola had with Lucas. And they went up and thought, this is weird. We don't want any part of this. Let's just go back to New York and make movies. So Scorsese's kind of, he's 1A to those three guys in the book because he is different and because he was consciously approaching things in a different kind of way.
Yeah. And listen, as we come to the end, you know, when we look at it now, in terms of creatively, forget about the eye-watering amounts of money they've all made, and in Coppola's case, sometimes lost. But, you know, when we look at them now, Lucas, you know, didn't really direct another movie past the Star Wars prequels. I know he produced all sorts of things, but he kind of became, you know, a mogul with Industrial Light and Magic, selling it to Disney and production roles and that. Coppola has, you know, tried, but there have been disasters. Like 2 years ago, Megapolis was, which I think we all agree was, we admire the ambition, but it just failed for my mind thoroughly. Whereas I've still been excited by, you know, The Fabelmans a couple of years ago, I thought was terrific. So to my eyes, he's the one who's creatively lasted the longest. But from all you've been reading and researching over the last years, what's your take on that? Am I being a bit reductive?
No, I agree. And I also think it kind of speaks to this thing of, you know, Coppola and Lucas being filmmakers, but also being interested in other things, you know, being in, you know, friends of Coppola's will go, oh, he wanted to be a novelist. He wanted to be a theater director. He wanted to run, you know, Mamarella's restaurant. And, you know, Lucas, I think, kind of always interested in machines, right? He's a kid who wanted to be a car racer. And then he gets interested in like sound and editing machines more than directing. Hated directing because you got to deal with other people and other people are hell. And so they've kind of reached this point where, you know, Coppola making a terrible film, but that's kind of like a circus adventure where he gambles everything. That feels very true to who he is. And Lucas becoming very rich and opening a museum somewhere, that feels very true to who he is. And then Spielberg, kind of living in this world he created where he's just making bangers every couple of years that people sort of don't pay as much attention to as they should because, again, they're watching a Spider-Man film that came out the next week instead. but I think all these, you know, West Side Story, The Fabelmans, all these late films, you know, if they weren't Steven Spielberg films, we'd be going, who made these? They're incredible. But we sort of take them for granted almost. So I'm with you.
Yeah. Well, listen, I could talk to you about this stuff all day, but I better leave you back to the day. I've been talking to Paul Fisher, author of The Last Kings of Hollywood, Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg, and The Battle for the Soul of American Cinema. It is a terrific book, Paul, and I will urge our listeners to go out and buy it in droves, either in their local bookshop or online. Thanks for taking the time, Paul.
Thank you very much. All the best, everyone.
Yes, Paul Fisher there talking about his fantastic new book, The Last Kings of Hollywood, all about Spielberg, Lucas, and Coppola, or Coppola, depending on your pronunciations. A great read, a fascinating story, and we could have spent a lot more time on that. Something else that's fascinating, at least I think so, is science in the movies and how it's used, and in particular, how it's used in Project Hail Mary. And Ireland's favourite scientist, Luke O'Neill, will be with me after the break. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and movie show. Now, 2 weeks ago on this show, we raved about Project Hail Mary, which sees Ryan Gosling as a teacher called Ryland Grace, who's sent on a mission to save our son. He befriends another life form along the way in the form of a puppet-like creation called Rocky. Neve Riley, when reviewing 2 weeks ago, said it was like Back to the Future, a modern classic. It's the second highest grossing film of the year so far and has been critically lauded. But what about the science? Well, Ireland's best known scientist and science communicator, Professor Luke O'Neill, has seen Project Hail Mary and he joins me now to take a deep dive into the science. Luke, hello, how are you?
How's it going, John?
Very well. Listen, I know you were kind of taken with some of the science in it. Like, it seems a bit outlandish. He's going to go off and somehow fight these amoeba-like creatures that are attacking the sun. Seemed all over the place. But from someone who knows, how wild is this an idea?
It's not bad, John. It's causing huge excitement among the scientific community because it's not quite as wild as it seems. Some is pretty wild, of course, outlandish, you know. But there is a scientific basis to what's going on. And Andy Weir, the guy who wrote it, you know, he consulted physicists and biologists and all sorts to make sure that at least some of the science was somewhat plausible. And us scientists, John, we think it's the best movie ever. It's a bit of exaggeration, but in terms of science fiction movies, it's as good as 2001: A Space Odyssey.
That's a bold claim. So tell me this. There's this thing called astrophages in
that's
it.
That's right.
And these are based on something that actually exists in science.
Sort of, yeah. They're tiny creatures. Now, they're fictional, of course, as we know. But they eat the sun. Astro means sun. Phage means to eat, you see. But guess what, John? I work on macrophages in the immune system, and they're big eaters. They eat bacteria. So the word astrophage kind of has a basis, you know. And, of course, the hero, Ryan Gosling, he's a molecular biologist. How cool is that? And he discovers the astrophages. That's one of his big discoveries in the movie, you know. And you can see them down a microscope, and there they are, you know, attacking the sun. That's what's causing the crisis.
The thing that these are loosely based on, there's billions of these around the world going through us at any one time, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's the next bit that's clever. So they go very, very fast. What Ryden Grace, he's the guy that Gosling plays, discovers, they're moving from the sun to Venus and back almost at the speed of light. And he spots this, you see, because he's a great scientist, you know. And they're using these things called neutrinos to power them. And again, that's not beyond the bounds of possibility. Neutrinos are tiny, tiny subatomic particles. They billions pass through our bodies, through the Earth every day. They come from the sun anyway, you know.
Yeah.
And obviously, Weir figured the astrophages feed off neutrinos. And it fuels them then on their oscillation between Venus and the sun. Now, again, it'd be very hard to catch neutrinos at the moment unless we discover astrophages. Then we can maybe be able to capture them.
And so I don't want to go down too much of a scientific rabbit hole, but I am fascinated. These neutrinos, as I stand talking to you now, there are billions of these everywhere?
Everywhere, yeah. Coming from the sun to the Earth, right? And they move through our bodies and we don't even feel them. And they're moving close to the speed of light. Pretty funky discovery by physicists, of course, you know? And once they discovered them, John, they knew they'd be a great source of energy, you know, if possible in the future. Capture the energy in these neutrinos that are going at the speed of light. And of course, that's our second thing about the movie. They use the power of the astrophages to build a spaceship to go very, very fast, to go off to another planet and then save the Earth. So they use the science of neutrinos as a source of fuel for the spaceship.
Right. But is it conceivable that these neutrinos will become a source of energy we can harness in the future?
Yeah, you're getting towards Star Trek in a way. Who will discover warp speed, John? That's the question. You know, so now physicists say it's far too difficult to capture them because they're going too fast, obviously. You know, they think it's really beyond the bounds of possibility. But you never know. Maybe some physicist somewhere in some obscure lab will crack the capturing of neutrinos, and then you might build a spaceship that will go near the speed of light.
Okay, but that's interesting. So, I mean, that Weir has loosely based by analogy his science on this. So that's not bad.
No, it's not bad. Yeah. And then also, John, you might know this, but in every cell in your body, there's things called mitochondria, and they're the source of energy for all of life, right?
Yeah.
And they use protons as their source of energy. This is real, like protons, you know? Whereas Weir said, oh, mate, these astrophages, they'll use neutrinos. So again, there's a parallel there with something that's real in our own bodies, you know? And John, also a Star Wars reference. Remember midichlorians? Remember those things?
Yeah.
They give the force. They were based on mitochondria. They sound like mitochondria midichlorians, you know. So other science fiction writers have sort of used this subatomic world
to inform
some of their science.
And was George Lucas cognizant of that?
Oh, he was. He picked the word midichlorian to sound like mitochondria. Because the mitochondria are the things in our bodies that give us the force, because they're the source of energy. And now they have midichlorians in Star Wars. By the way, John, I love this. I love when science fiction isn't total fantasy. You know, it's kind of a bit of reality. So that's my preference, really.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And tell me this. Another thing in the movie, Ryan Gosling, they put him into a kind of hibernation, suspended animation to help him travel to these planets or this place that's light years away. You know, if we were to go to Mars or elsewhere, is this something we'd be doing to astronauts, putting them to sleep, in essence?
Absolutely. And in fact, the European Space Agency, as we speak, is investigating putting people into a torpor, we call it, like just an animation. And of course, the inspiration, John, is hibernation. And again, Weir draws on that, really, you know. So we know things like bears and hamsters hibernate. We know certain creatures like salamanders, they almost go to freezing, you know, they last for months and months and months, you know. So the question is, could you recreate what's happening in a salamander or a wood frog, another famous creature that almost freezes? Could that be done in humans? And this is essential for the movie, John, because it takes them 13 years to get to the other planet, the other star, you think. And of course, you have to be put into a torpor to spend 13 years in that sort of suspended animation state. So again, that bit of trying to get people to hibernate is a very active area of research, because to go to Mars, as you say, it could take 2 years. If you put someone into kind of a hibernated state, that could make it much more feasible.
Yeah. And in terms of hibernating someone like that, if we get to a point where we can do that, aside from, you know, keeping them asleep in order that they travel so far away, is there any benefit to their bodies, or is there any harm to the body if that's done?
Again, it's a very active area. Because if you can imagine transplantation for a transplant an organ, say a kidney or a liver, right? If you could put that into a kind of a torpor state, it won't get damaged over time. It's like putting someone in the fridge, effectively, you know, and biologically you won't degrade then. So this research is also about trying to preserve organs for transplantation. Yeah. The risk is, John, as you thaw out, ice crystals form, right? And they can rip cells apart. They can burst cells like balloons, is the famous phrase. So the question is, can you stop ice crystals forming? And some of these creatures do that. So the wood frog uses a special sugar. There's fish that live in the Arctic. They use special proteins. They're like an antifreeze, really. We're talking like a natural antifreeze here. So the question is, could we use antifreezes, inject them into Ryan Gosling or whatever, you know, and then put them into this suspended animation state. And then when he thaws out, there won't be ice crystals to burst all his organs open, is the idea, you know?
Yeah. Now, you, long time ago on this show, talked about your favourite movie of all time. And if I'm not mistaken, it was With Nail and I, right?
That's right. Well remembered.
If there's a science movie that the science turns you on when you watch, because I'm sure there's lots of movies where the science isn't, but is it 2001 Space Odyssey?
Yeah, it has to be, John. There's your Sergeant Pepper equivalent, you know what I mean? Beatles fan. Oh, yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know what you think. I mean, that's the most amazing. That notion that Arthur C. Clarke had, that aliens come to Earth to allow us to evolve, is the idea there, as opposed to invading us and killing us, you know? Mm. Those aliens wanted us to progress, and it's a wonderful movie. That's a bit long now. Nowadays, I hear people find it too long and a bit tedious. It was probably inspired by LSD, as you remember that famous scene, you know? But no, that's my favourite by far,
yeah. Yeah. And then finally, we are talking about Project Hail Mary. So, I mean, would this be a good one to take the kids to spark an interest in science, do you think?
You've got the coolest guy at the moment, isn't he? Yes. Ryan Gosling, first of all. There's a guy to make into your hero. He's the astronaut. He's a school teacher. Fair play to him.
Yes.
Get out the school teachers everywhere. You know, it's great, you know. He inspires his students. And there he is, saving the sun, saving the earth and going off into space, you know. And I think it's a great example of how science can be exciting. Mm. Yeah, and get the kids to discuss what we're discussing. You know,
yeah.
A good project for a school kid. Is there any basis for the science? Now, of course, it could ruin them for them, sadly. You may remember, John, when you went on tours, they gave you a thing to fill in and you're bored. You know? But it could be an opportunity to explore science. So absolutely, people should bring their young relations and young friends to see this movie.
Yeah, fantastic. You've put a whole different spin on this movie for me. Then finally, like, so obviously he befriends this other life form. They call him Rocky. Every science fiction movie somehow seems to largely involve other life forms. I mean, as a betting man, as a scientist, are there other life forms out there? I know that's the $50 million question.
Yeah. Well, some think they're here already, John, and they call themselves Hungarians. That was a famous joke. I think it's almost certain we will find life. Nothing unique about the Earth. Remember, there's all these exoplanets that are in the Goldilocks zone for life to form. We think now billions of them, you know, and it's a numbers game in the end of random chemicals interacting, forming life. So we're pretty confident. Now, it may be life, John, but not as we know it. You know?
Yes.
See that?
He used a Star Trek quote. This guy's on fire.
That's right. We will find alien life eventually. The trouble is, by the time we find it, the trouble will be too late. We might have become extinct by the time they arrive, you know. So we might not actually encounter them at all, you know.
That's a sobering thought. Well, that has been Professor Luke O'Neill flying the flag for the science in Project Hail Mary, which is still very much in your local cinema. And Luke is saying you will enjoy it as an adult and your kids might learn something about science. Luke, thanks a million.
Thanks very much, John.
Luke O'Neill there discussing the science of movies, and indeed the science particularly in Project Hail Mary. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. Do get in touch with me at any stage. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday evening at 6 o'clock here on Newstalk. And indeed, it's been on this Easter Monday as well at 6 o'clock. Because, you know, you can't get enough of a good thing or other some such cliche. Leave you with a little music from the movies. This song by The Pretenders, don't get me wrong, has been used in lots of movies. Loads of them. Bridget Jones, all sorts of ones. Too many to mention. Or maybe I just can't remember which other ones. Who knows? I guess we'll never know. So I'll leave you with the sweet sounds of The Pretenders and Chrissie Hynde with Don't Get Me Wrong from various movies. And wish you a happy remainder to your weekend and your Easter weekend.